You're listening to This Week in Palestine, a space where truth is not trimmed to fit the margins, where resistance is not a metaphor, and where solidarity is not seasonal. From the heart of occupation, voices rise, not alone, but in chorus, with movements across the globe that demand justice, dignity, and liberation. This isn't just a broadcast. It's a lifeline, a thread that stretches from Gaza to the world, from shattered homes to unshaken hope, from the rubble to the resolve. Each week, we bring you reporting that refuses euphemism, analysis that cuts through distortion, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, defiance, and humanity. We trace the scaffolding of empire, the policies that suffocate, the narratives that erase, the weapons that silence. And we follow their echoes across borders, from Ferguson to Jenin, from refugee camps to classrooms, from Gaza to the global conscience. Before we begin, a necessary reminder. The views expressed during this hour belong to our hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. This is not a space for polite avoidance or sanitized soundbites. It is a space for truth, bold, urgent, and unapologetic. Good morning, good evening, wherever you're tuning in from, thank you for being here. I'm your host and narrator, Abby Masri, and it is a deep and humbling honor to welcome you back to This Week in Palestine. Today is Sunday, November 9th, 2025, and once again, our gaze turns to Gaza and the West Bank, lands under siege, where homes are reduced to dust, where lives are uprooted, where voices struggle to rise above the din of global indifference. As headlines fade and attention shifts, the truth remains: Palestinians continue to resist, even as the threat of reinvasion looms. Let's be honest, Israel has never sought peace. It has sought opportunity. Opportunity to ethnically cleanse, to erase, to rewrite history with bulldozers and bombs. And the world knows. The world watches. Some in silence, some in complicity. But will it finally reckon with the cost of that silence? Will it finally choose conscience over convenience, action over apathy? And still, one question refuses to fade. How long must a people suffer before the world decides to care? Stay with us as we strip away the silence, as we uplift resilience, as we carry forward the flame of justice. This journey is not mine alone. It's ours. It's shared. It's urgent and it's sacred. Before we begin today's episode, I want to take a moment to acknowledge a seismic political shift, one that has sent shockwaves through the corridors of power. Zohran Mamdani has just been elected mayor of New York City. This wasn't just a win, it was a revolution. He didn't just defeat his opponents, he overcame a coordinated campaign backed by billionaires, establishment power brokers, and even the sitting president, all of whom were openly bidding on his defeat. They poured millions into attack ads. They labeled him radical, inexperienced, dangerous. They tried to bury him beneath headlines and smear campaigns. But the people of New York had other plans. Zohran Mamdani's victory is historic, not only because he is the city's first Muslim, South Asian, and African-born mayor, and not only because he's the youngest to hold the office in over a century. It's historic because of how he won. Let's talk about that. First, and perhaps most courageously, he refused to be silent on Palestine. He was the only mayoral candidate who said clearly and unapologetically that he would not travel to Israel. "I will stay in New York," he declared. "My duty is here." That single statement ignited a firestorm. He was immediately bombarded with questions, accused of anti-Semitism, not just by Zionist organizations, but by rival candidates and media pundits alike. But Mamdani didn't flinch. He stood firm, drawing a line between principled criticism of a state and hatred of a people. He reminded the public that justice is not negotiable and that silence in the face of apartheid is complicity. And that was just the beginning. A singular message, affordability, while his opponents leaned on fear, crime stats, and political resumes, Mamdani spoke directly to the lived reality of working-class New Yorkers. His slogan, "A City We Can Afford," wasn't just a campaign line, it was a promise. He called for free public buses, universal childcare, rent stabilization, and city-run grocery stores. He made affordability the moral center of his campaign, and it resonated. 2. Relentless consistency. From his launch video to his final rally, Mamdani never wavered. He didn't pivot to appease donors. He didn't soften his stance to win headlines. He spoke with clarity. Life doesn't have to be this hard. Government should make it easier. Even disillusioned voters, and yes, even some conservatives, found themselves nodding along. That's not just messaging. That's movement building. 3. Grassroots everywhere. He didn't rely on traditional media. He showed up in mosques, subway stations, LGBTQ bars at 1 a.m., and TikTok live streams with creators. He held press conferences for influencers, not just journalists. He ran ads on Fox News and spoke from DJ booths. He was everywhere, and he was real. 4. Turning inexperience into power. While establishment candidates boasted about decades in office, Mamdani leaned into his outsider status. He didn't pretend to know every lever of power. He promised to pull new ones. He framed himself not as a politician, but as a public servant ready to disrupt the status quo. 5. A coalition of the unheard. Young voters, renters, immigrants, artists, teachers, people who had never voted before showed up. People who had given up on politics found hope. And that hope translated into the highest voter turnout in New York City in nearly 60 years. So today, before we begin our episode, we pause to recognize what just happened. New York didn't just elect a mayor. It issued a mandate for justice, a mandate for affordability, a mandate for a city that belongs to its people, not its billionaires. Congratulations, Mayor Zoharan Mamdani. The world is watching, and the people are ready. Israel and Netanyahu fear Zoharan Mamdani because he represents a bold, unapologetic challenge to their political legitimacy, especially in the heart of New York City, a global center of Jewish life and media influence. Mamdani's stance on Palestine, his support for BDS, and his threat to arrest Netanyahu signal a seismic shift in American political discourse. Let's take a look. He supports BDS and makes it mainstream. Zoharan Mamdani has long supported the boycott, divestment, and sanctions BDS movement, which calls for nonviolent pressure on Israel to comply with international law. He's made clear that his support for BDS is rooted in a commitment to justice and nonviolence, not hatred. This terrifies Israeli officials and pro-Israel lobby groups. Why? Because BDS is often portrayed as fringe or extremist. Mamdani, by contrast, is charismatic, principled, and now mayor of the largest city in the U.S. His support gives BDS legitimacy and visibility in a way few American politicians ever have. Next, he threatened to arrest Netanyahu. In a move that stunned political observers, Mamdani publicly stated that if elected mayor, he would enforce the International Criminal Court's arrest warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu should the Israeli leader visit New York. This wasn't symbolic. Mamdani said he would direct the NYPD to arrest Netanyahu for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity committed during the Gaza War. That statement alone sent shockwaves through diplomatic and legal circles. It signaled that Mamdani sees international law as binding, even when the federal government refuses to act. For Netanyahu, this is more than rhetoric. It's a direct threat to his ability to travel freely and maintain global legitimacy. Next, he centers Palestine in his identity. Mamdani has said that the Palestinian cause is central to my identity. He's appeared alongside Palestinian organizers, spoken at pro-Palestine rallies, and refused to visit Israel as a political gesture of solidarity. This is unprecedented for a mayor of New York City, a city with the largest Jewish population in the world. His refusal to play the diplomatic game, to balance his stance, or to appease Zionist institutions is seen as dangerous by Israeli officials. It breaks the mold of American politicians who either avoid the issue or offer tepid support for Palestinian rights. Next, he's changing the narrative. Mamdani's election shows that being pro-Palestine is no longer political suicide. He won despite relentless attacks, smear campaigns, and accusations of anti-Semitism. And he won big. This shift terrifies Israel's defenders. It suggests that the old playbook, labeling critics as anti-Semitic, flooding media with fear, no longer works. Mamdani didn't just survive the attacks, he thrived. Next, he's building a coalition that can't be ignored. Mamdani's support base includes young voters, immigrants, artists, and progressive Jews who reject Netanyahu's policies. According to CNN exit polls, many Jewish voters supported Mamdani because of his stance on Israel. This fractures the traditional alliance between American Jewish institutions and Israeli policy. It shows that Netanyahu's support is eroding, even among Jews. And Mamdani is the face of that shift. In short, Mamdani is feared because he's principled, popular, and unafraid. He doesn't just criticize Israel, he challenges its impunity. And now he holds office. Now, shifting our focus back to This Week in Palestine, I want to share with you a compelling segment that dives deep into the ideological roots of Zionism, how it was not born in the Holy Land, but imported from Europe as a colonial project. The clip is titled, "Professor Exposes Secret Origins of the Israel Project," and the voice behind it is Dr. Yaakov M. Rabkin. Dr. Rabkin is a professor emeritus of history at the University of Montreal, with over 300 publications to his name. His research spans science, politics, and Jewish history, but it's his work on Zionism that has stirred global conversations. In this interview, Rabkin dismantles the common narrative that Zionism is a natural extension of Judaism. Instead, he argues that Zionism is a form of European ethnic nationalism, rooted not in Jewish theology, but in the secular ideologies of 19th century Europe. He traces its origins to Protestant Christian fantasies about restoring Jews to the Holy Land, ideas that were later adopted by secular Jews in Russia and Central Europe, many of whom were influenced by revolutionary movements and colonial ambitions. Rabkin explains that traditional Jewish communities, especially religious ones, overwhelmingly rejected Zionism when it first emerged. They saw it as a betrayal of Jewish values, a dangerous political experiment, and a distortion of sacred teachings. He also reveals how early Zionists formed strategic alliances with anti-Semites, who supported the idea of Jewish immigration, not out of solidarity, but to rid Europe of its Jewish population. These alliances, Rabkin argues, expose the cynical underbelly of the Zionist project. In his book, A Threat from Within, A Century of Jewish Opposition to Zionism, Rabkin documents how Zionism uprooted ancient Jewish communities, replaced spiritual identity with territorial nationalism, and paved the way for violence and dispossession in Palestine. He doesn't speak from abstraction, he speaks from history, from archives, from lived experience. Rabkin's critique is not anti-Jewish, it is deeply Jewish. It is rooted in a tradition that values exile, humility, and ethical responsibility, not conquest. In the clip, he also discusses the role of political terrorism in early Zionist movements, the marginalization of nonviolent factions, and the enduring support Zionism receives from Western powers, despite its colonial nature. This is not just academic theory, it's a lens through which we can understand the present, the violence in Gaza, the apartheid in the West Bank, the silencing of dissent abroad. So if you've ever wondered how Zionism came to dominate the political landscape of Palestine, this clip is essential viewing. Dr. Yaakov Rabkin doesn't just expose the origins of the Israel Project, he invites us to rethink everything we thought we knew. Let's listen.
It's important to remember that Zionism is a European movement. It's European ethnic nationalism of Poland, Lithuania, that is transferred to Palestine. Very often it's exclusionary nationalism, because you can have inclusive nationalism, like in France, you know, you become citoyen, and that's enough. But there is also the ethnic nationalism, which today is very much in evidence in many countries, in Poland, in Ukraine, in Latvia, Estonia, and so on. So this was transferred into Palestine, and that became the ideological basis of Zionism.
Hello, everybody. This is Pascal from Neutrality Studies, and today I'm talking to Dr. Yaakov Rapkin, a professor emeritus of history at the University of Montreal. His publications include over 300 articles and several monographs and edited volumes. His newest work is a short but highly fascinating account about Israel in Palestine, Jewish rejection of Zionism. This fascinating work is what we want to discuss today. So, Professor Rapkin, welcome.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for taking the time, because you've written this fantastic book, which I really think is very illuminating. And maybe let's start with this very important distinction, conceptual distinction, between what is Zionism, what is Judaism, and what is Israel as a concept, the modern Israel and the ancient Israel of the Bible. Can you maybe talk about this?
Right. Well, Judaism is a religion. It's a religion that was centered on the temple in Jerusalem. Then, about 2,000 years ago, that religion became, so to speak, portable, as Jews around the Mediterranean first, and later around the world, practice a religion that is based on the books, essentially. Till the mid-20th century, Judaism was considered one of the three monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And just like in Islam, there is a community of the faithful, so Ummah. That's how the term Am Israel, or the people of Israel, was conceived. People who are loyal to the Torah, to the message, a divine message given on Mount Sinai, and those who practice this. So, in fact, Jews, one could become a Jew by converting to Judaism, and still can't do that. And Israel traditionally is meant as a group of people faithful to those commandments in Torah. Now, when the State of Israel was created in 1948, the word Israel became associated in many minds, and most, I think, with the modern state, which is a very different thing. Now, how did this happen? This happened thanks to Zionism. Zionism is a political movement. It became Jewish at the end of the 19th century. Originally, the idea of ingathering Hebrews in the Holy Land was a Christian Protestant idea in some marginal groups first, and then more mainstream groups, particularly in 19th century England, not Britain, not only England. This is how eventually, by the end of the 19th century, some Jews, mostly Jews who were alienated from religion, who were sort of acculturated to the European civilization, decided that they would have a state for the Jews in Palestine. We can talk about later how this happened. So Zionism is a political movement. Some Jews enthusiastically embraced it. When Zionism emerged, the vast majority of Jews rejected it.
And I mean, it's fascinating that you're saying that Zionism originated actually with Protestant Christians. So do we actually find writings of people, like Protestant Christians, who say, like, we need to gather the Jews in Palestine. I mean, it's very necessary. And why would that be? So why is this not even an original Jewish idea, actually, to do that?
Well, this has to do with the history of Protestantism, with the translation of the Bible into vernaculars. Traditionally, Christian Church, Catholic Church, interpreted the Bible. It didn't really encourage reading the Bible, but it encouraged interpretations of the Bible. The Jewish idea of relationship with the Holy Land, or to be more specific in Hebrew, it's the land of holiness. It's not Holy Land. So the relationship is conditional. And you can open Genesis, the Bible, Pentateuch, and the promise of that land is a divine promise, was given on certain conditions, that one has to obey the commandments and live properly. Otherwise, you will be exiled from the land. And the very strong expression, the land will vomit you out if you don't behave. So that's the message in the Pentateuch and in the prophets as well. And when Protestantism came around and reading the Bible became common, they gave away, so to speak, interpretation and tradition. They read it directly, and they interpreted it literally. In Judaism, literal interpretation is not favored at all. And very often, you know, I can give you one example of, you may have heard that Jews are not supposed to mix dairy and meat products in the same meal. Now, where does it come from? It comes from one biblical verse that says, do not cook a kid in the milk of its mother. Mm. Just one kid and its mother. And it was expanded into the whole idea of dairy and meat. So just to give you one example of how things are interpreted and become part of the tradition. The Protestants read biblical prophecies of return to Holy Land. And some of them developed the idea that by ingathering the Hebrews into their land, into the Holy Land, you can speed the second coming of Christ. And that is really the motivation. Today, Christian Zionists, as we call them today, are very numerous. And there are millions and millions of people, according to Pastor Hagee in the United States, who was one of the activists. He said at one point that there were more than 50 million Christian Zionists in the United States. Just for information, there are about 15 million Jews in the world. So there's quite a difference between Christian Zionists and Jewish Zionists. So that's why Christian Zionism is so strong today, because it's based on the literal interpretation of the Bible, plus some other things that we can discuss later.
Yeah, and the problem, of course, I mean, as we all who are watching this program probably understand, is the issue that you then gather an entire group of people who used to live somewhere completely different parts of the world, not just in Europe, but also in other countries in the Middle East and so on, and you put them there and you displace the people who were there. And in your book, you actually quote I think he's a rabbi, Yaakov Zur, and who says Zionism is the most terrible enemy that has ever arisen to the Jewish nation. Zionism kills the nation and then elevates the corpse to the throne. Can you explain this quote by Yaakov Zur?
Well, the idea of ingathering the Hebrews by political means, let alone military means, is totally alien to the Jewish tradition. Because in Jewish tradition, the relationship with the Holy Land is a very normative relations. In other words, There was a French Jewish philosopher, Emmanuel Levinas, and he, as many French do, had a pun. Ce n'est pas une terre promise, c'est une terre permise. So it's not a promised land, it's a permitted land. Well, in French it sounds better. And indeed, it's a permitted land. So it's under certain conditions. To prevent the temptation of returning by political or military means, the Talmud, which is the normative code of discussions, redacted between, say, 5th and 6th centuries, Talmud says, actually lists three oaths which prevent Jews, or should prevent them, to return to the Holy Land before the coming of Messiah and all that. So when Zionism emerged, I repeat, among people who were very far from the Jewish tradition, most Jews rejected it, and they rejected it for three reasons. One was theological, if you like, that one is not supposed to do it according to normative Jewish texts, and moreover, converting a nation or a group that is defined by a loyalty to divine commandments into a regular nationality was something that obviously religious Jews didn't appreciate. So that's why the quote you gave, that's an enemy of the Jewish nation, so to speak. Again, the word nation is problematic here because we understand it in modern sense, but it's a biblical term, so which meant something very different. Again, it's a community of the faithful. Second reason for rejecting Zionism among Jews was that many Jews in the 19th century in Europe, and we are talking about a European phenomenon, Zionism, an entirely European phenomenon, they were adjusting to the new conditions after emancipation. They received civil rights from Napoleon and afterwards. They became citizens of their countries, France, when Germany was reunited, then it was Germany. And the last thing they wanted is to be told that they belong to some different nation. Yeah, so they heard the Zionist message as a variation of an anti-Semitic message. You don't belong here, go to Palestine. And indeed, many anti-Semites felt like that, including Christian Zionists in Britain. Just to give you one example, most people heard about the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration in 1917 that promised the creation of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. No one knows what exactly it was meant, which is typical British diplomatic approach. Balfour, before he became foreign minister, was instrumental in preventing Russian Jews from immigrating to Britain. So one goes hand in hand with the other. Mm-hmm. And indeed, anti-Semites were often very sympathetic to Zionism.
In your book, actually, or maybe it was in the talk that I saw with Jeffrey Sachs, you actually mentioned that the Balfour Declaration, the one cabinet member in Britain that voted against it was the only Jew in the cabinet. Can you give that anecdote as well?
Of course, it was Mr. Montague. who was the member of the British, the only Jewish member of the British government. And he published a declaration against Zionism, accusing British government of anti-Semitism, because they were pro-Zionist. And but there was a third group I would like to mention that opposed, a third reason that opposed Zionism. Those were quite a few socialists and communists and left groups who saw in Zionism a distraction of the Jewish working class from class struggle, a distraction from transformation of society. And saw in Zionism a bourgeois nationalism, which it was and is, which is detrimental to the socialist cause. And in fact, many founders of the State of Israel were socialists and went into extreme length to reconcile their socialism with Zionism. Very difficult task.
When you try to square a circle or fold yourself into a pretzel, but these early Zionists, the early Jewish Zionists, and the most important one being Mr. Herzl, right, who wrote also an entire thesis about this and the intellectual underpinnings. How did they reconcile Zionism with Judaism? Did they from the beginning say basically this has little to do with religion, this is just what we need as a national group, period?
Well, you mentioned Theodor Herzl, who was a very successful Austrian journalist and playwright of Jewish Hungarian origin. He was born in Budapest. And he was very concerned about the oppression of Jews in Russia and Russian Empire, where emancipation didn't exist, and Jews were confined to a certain pale of settlement, which today corresponds to the western, to the western part of the former Russian Empire, which is today Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Ukraine, Moldova, Belarus. So these are the areas where Jews were concentrated, and they didn't have equal rights. And they were suffering after 1881 from periodic waves of violence, which was called pogroms. So that was one concern. But more importantly for Theodor Herzl, there was a concern of people like him who were successful intellectuals, successful maybe doctors and everyone, but they suffered from anti-Semitism because anti-Semites resented their social mobility. They resented it. And Herzl wanted to get rid of this. How do you get rid? His first idea before he embraced Zionism was to convert all the Jews of Vienna into Catholicism. Well, I think the Archbishop didn't quite appreciate the idea, nor did the Jews. So his second idea was Zionism. And just to mention how strong the opposition was, you've heard that the first Zionist Congress in 1897 was held at that time in still a relatively small town of Basel in Switzerland. Now, why Basel? There were much more important centers of Jewish population. And indeed, the Zionist Congress was supposed to take place in Munich, Germany. But German Jewish organizations petitioned the government to forbid the holding of a Zionist Congress. And it was moved to Basel.
They saw it as a threat.
Switzerland, as you know, is a very tolerant place.
For better or worse. And worse. But you then also write about the the role of violence in Zionism, and that this is also part of, you know, this rejection of Judaism, which is a very peaceful religion, actually, at least the way I read it. But there is very a lot of violence especially in the Old Testament. But if I look at the way that the Jews in Europe, you know, they were never, at least I don't know of large violent events in Europe. I only know of the Jews being on the receiving end of extreme violence. Pogroms were not unique to Russia. They had been done by the Roman Empire of the German nation and so on all throughout these ages. Why is it then that starting from the 1880s, you start seeing Zionist violence toward people living in Palestine at the time?
Well, you're totally right that violence was abhorred by the Jewish tradition. Whether it was a virtue or a necessity is something else. Because Jews didn't have political power. When you don't have political power, you don't exercise violence, yeah, or collective violence, at least. And there were Jewish scholars and rabbis who raised this question. Are we peaceful because we don't have an opportunity to be violent, or just we are peaceful by principle? And one of them is Yehuda Levi in the medieval Spain, who wrote a book, Kuzari, which is translated into various languages. And you could see the dialogue which raises this issue. Now, talking about violence, Zionist violence, here we're talking about that. There are two reasons. One is the logic of colonial settlement. And in every colonial settlement in the world, where an alien group comes into a land which is already populated by someone else, there is friction. Sometimes it becomes violence. Most times it becomes violence. And therefore, there was a logic to that development, which has nothing to do with Judaism or Jewish tradition. It's just the same thing happened all over the world where Europeans tried to colonize different countries. Second reason is that, as I mentioned, many of the young Zionist settlers who went to Palestine, and I must mention that there were less than 1% of all those who emigrated from the Russian Empire went to Palestine. It's a very small group of people, but very active, very articulate group, very devoted group of people. And they embraced violence also because they had the experience of underground revolutionary work in the Russian Empire. Many of them were active in Socialist Revolutionist Party in the first Russian Revolution of 1905. So they knew how to fight a regime. They knew how to fight enemies. And there were also self-defense groups during pogroms in the early 20th century. So they came, they went to Palestine already with this experience. And also, very importantly, with the experience of political terrorism, because those revolutionary underground movements practiced political terrorism. They are the ones who killed the Emperor Alexander II in 1881 in St. Petersburg. Of course, in that particular assassination, Jews were not directly involved, but Jews were overrepresented among those revolutionary groups for good reason, because they were perhaps one of the most oppressed parts of the population. So when these young Zionists went to Palestine to build a new socialist society, that was the idea, they confronted local population. And they used this in their life in the beginning of the settlement. But as far as I know, the first victim of Zionist terrorism, political terrorism, was a Jew. In 1924, Yaakov Dahan, a Dutch Jew who became active as a spokesman for religious anti-Zionists in Jerusalem, rabbis, very revered rabbis, he was organizing a delegation of rabbis to go to London to convince the authorities to prevent the Zionist takeover of the country. He was just assassinated when he was leaving the synagogue in 1924, and his idea was never realized. And later, the people who did it admitted it and were proud of that act. So it's not a hypothesis, it's an historical fact. So in fact, that's how the tradition of political violence and terrorism was transferred to Palestine and was practiced by Zionist groups for quite a long time.
Were there ever groups of Zionists who actually were non-violent, or who said we should live in Palestine, but with the Palestinians, with the locals, and who opposed this strain, but then lost out to them. And I suppose what happened then is that these people who are pro-violence, political violence, they then started forming the state, the proto-state agencies, that would be my guess.
Well, of course, there were different groups. Most leaders of the Zionist movement in Palestine came from the Russian Empire, came from the background I just described. But there were other groups. There were German Jews in particular, who played a very important role in building up the Zionist infrastructure, industrial, intellectual, particularly those who went to Palestine after 1933, after the election of Hitler in Germany. Many of them, were opposed to the idea of a separate development. And the separate development, I'm not referring to the South African term apartheid. I'm referring to the Hebrew term, which actually is older than apartheid. It's called afrada, to separation. The idea was to create a separate economy, separate society in Palestine. So many German Jews, prominent German Jews, and some American Jews, formed associations like Brit Shalom, the Alliance of Peace, for example, who argued for a common state for both local population and immigrant Jews to have an independent country where they would live together, which is the norm, say, in Montreal, where I live, where different groups live together. They not necessarily love each other, but they live together. Those German and American Jews largely lost out to the Russian Zionists. And I'm saying Russian Zionists because even in 1960, two-thirds of the Israeli parliament were born in the Russian Empire. Mm. And there was no immigration after 1921 from Russia to anywhere. It's a very important part of the Zionist history, the role of Russian Zionists and the transfer of the political tradition of the violence and terrorism into Palestine. Now, that became a common Israeli culture. You see, this is important to see that they say the assassin of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin, the assassin of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was a Yemenite Jew, was of Yemenite tradition. So, but this Russian tradition or Russian revolutionary tradition became Israeli tradition. So today it's not identified with Russians in particular. It became standard mode of operation and standard mode of looking at Arabs, looking at Palestinians, in Israel today. So that's why this Russian connection, so to speak, is very important. And I may mention, I don't remember, an article I wrote with a colleague of mine, Yaakov Yadgar, at Oxford, on the Russian roots of Israeli political culture.
Maybe this is a bit of a sideshow, but what did that do to Judaism in West Asia, in the Middle East? I saw a couple of interviews with Abi Schleim, and he mentioned that when he was born as a Jew in Baghdad, and as his childhood, he remembers that being firmly aware that he's in Baghdad, and then like being moved or moving in like events back in the late 40s and 50s and 60s then into Israel that really uprooted many Middle Eastern Jewish traditions.
You're totally right. Avi Schleim wrote a wonderful memoir. I liked reading it, and I even wrote a book review. I think that It's important to remember that Zionism is a European movement. It's European ethnic nationalism of Poland, Lithuania, that is transferred to Palestine. Very often it's exclusionary nationalism, because you can have inclusive nationalism, like in France, you know, you become citoyen, and that's enough. But there is also the ethnic nationalism, which today is very much in evidence in many countries, in Poland, in Ukraine, in Latvia, Estonia, and so on. So this was transferred into Palestine, and that became the ideological basis of Zionism. Now, for Jews who lived in countries outside of Europe, this was totally alien. Actually, Avi Schleim calls his mother, when he first asked about what is Zionism, said, oh, it's an Ashkenazi thing. It's a thing of European Jews. It's not our thing. And indeed, it wasn't. It had to be transplanted there. There were emissaries of the Zionist movement who went to Iraq, among other places, to Morocco, to other places, to particularly influence the young people. Sometimes they used just sort of convincing. Sometimes they used provocation. So there were provocations like anti-Jewish violence, which was really organized by a Zionist group in order to frighten Jews to emigrate. In Iraq, it's a very different story. There, it also had violence, but there was also an agreement with the Iraqi government to allow immigration. But what happened finally with countries, most countries where Jews lived for centuries, in Iraq for millennia, they were uprooted and they were brought to then Israel, young Israel. Now, why was it done? Because I just mentioned there was a European movement for European Jews. Why would they need Jews of Iraq or Morocco?
Labor.
Well, they needed them because European Jews had been decimated by the Nazi genocide. And they had to populate the country. They expelled the Palestinians, but you had to fill up those places. And so, by necessity, they turned to Jewish population in those in Muslim countries, Muslim majority countries. And in most countries, they were practically all uprooted. There are very few Jews left in Morocco, in Turkey more, in Iran more. Say Iranian Jews, for example, they've been there for 2,500 years. And they also have to understand that whereas Jews in Europe, Jews in Eastern and Central Europe, we are talking about those kind of Jews, they were concentrated in one area. They spoke a different language. They spoke Yiddish. So they were kind of pre-nationalists, if you like. They spoke the same language. They lived in the same country. They had more or less the same economic conditions. And they were different from the majority population. So they spoke Yiddish and they practiced something else. Now, Jews in Iran or Iraq spoke the language of the country. Yeah. They considered themselves Iranians or Iraqis or whatever, or Baghdadis, because Iraq was created by British colonialism. So they considered themselves Baghdadis that practiced a different religion. And there were all kinds of people in Baghdad. Some practiced Christianity, some practiced Zoroastrian, whatever. But they considered themselves Iranians or Iraqis or Baghdadis. And actually, I was in Iran in 2016 and visited Jewish communities. And it happened to be the New Year, the Iranian New Year, which is Nowruz. It was Shabbat. Friday night, and we were going to a synagogue, and people met in the street, obviously knew each other, and they said, Shabbat Shalom, Nowruz Mubarak, in one sentence, because that's how the fusion of the two cultures, if you like. So yeah. For them, yeah, go ahead.
Sorry, because I read that the Jewish community in Iran is small, but still around 9,000 people. That's the number that I read about. And when we had the most recent 12-day war between Israel, United States, and Iran, that there were also that the Jewish community in Iran was very vocal of saying, like, stop this. Israel must stop this horrible onslaught. This has nothing to do with the Jewish cause. And the reply from the Zionists was, oh, this is a form of Stockholm syndrome. Iran is holding these people captive and is paying them or doing horrible things to them in order to say that. Can we firmly reject that premise and say, like, no, these are just integrated Jewish Iranians?
Yeah, well, the history is very different. Say, in Iran, the history of Jews is very different from history of Jews in Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, they speak the same language, they have the same customs, but they practice a different religion. So it's very important to understand that the projection of East European ethnic nationalism onto non-European countries always creates tension, violence, and problems.
Yeah.
Well, it creates tension, violence, and problems in Eastern Europe, as you could see as well. But I think it's those countries that saw their Jews as regular citizens or regular subjects of the king or whatever regime there was, were very different from East European, even putative democracies that discriminated against the Jews. In Iran, just to take one example, when I was in 2016, there were 4 kosher restaurants in Iran, but more importantly, there were no armed guards in front of synagogues, unlike Europe.
Yeah.
And we're talking about a very anti-Zionist regime, right, in Iran. But the Jews didn't feel that they are targeted or they're in danger. In Europe, if you're looking for a synagogue and it's a town you're not familiar with, a police car would be a good indication of where a synagogue is, but not in Iran.
In Europe, then, this is taken as proof that support for Israel is very important, very necessary, because European anti-Semitism is the problem. But I mean, what comes out of the research that you're doing is that anti-Semitism is a reason for Zionism to be there in the first place and segregate basically the Jews from the Europeans.
Right. Well, Germany today, contemporary Germany, is a very good example of that. That unconditional support of Israel, that support for Israel becomes the raison d'état of Germany. This is, I personally published even an article on the 60th anniversary of Israel in, I think it was Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. Where I saw that, well, it's very understandable and praiseworthy to compensate victims of the genocide, but you mistake Israel for Jews. So they're two different things. But, and in fact, the values that Israel practices are much closer to the German regime that caused damage to Jews than it is to anything else.
You're a very careful man with the way that you phrase your sentences, but which is a good thing, which is a very diplomatic thing. This likening, this equating, we see that at the moment on Twitter for the last 2 years, nonstop. Like, Zionism is Judaism, and the Jews, if anyone is against Zionism, he's against the Jews, and he's against Israel, and Israel is the Jews. And people like Jeffrey Sachs reject that publicly and say, like, no, you, Mr. Netanyahu, the state of Israel doesn't speak for me. Stop doing that. You're causing more harm than you do good. But has this been going on with Zionism from the beginning? Or is this equating actually something newer?
Well, in his diary, Theodor Herzl said correctly that anti-Semites will be our most loyal allies. Because, as I said, they want to get rid of the Jews. Herzl wants to take them to Palestine. So they have a confluence of interests. And in fact, I can go even further. There is an Israeli film I would like to recommend. It's called The Flat. If you allow me a couple of minutes, I'll explain what it is about. The grandson of a chairman of the Zionist organization of Germany in the 1930s goes through the papers of his deceased grandfather, and he finds an SS newspaper with a picture of himself, of his grandfather, and someone else. And he discovers that in 1934, if I'm not mistaken, the Nazi leadership sent someone to Palestine. In fact, the Zionists originated this. They wanted to invite Nazis who were interested in Jewish affairs to visit Palestine and to see how the Jews can be resettled, because Nazis wanted to get rid of the Jews. They didn't want originally to assassinate everyone. They wanted just to, so to speak, to cleanse Germany from Jews. And Zionists went along. And so there was a trip organized for this SS officer and the chairman of the Zionist Federation of Germany. And they traveled together. And as a result, there were a series of very positive articles written in the SS newspaper that the grandson found in the archive of his good grandfather. And not only that, he also found a medal that was coined on that occasion, something like "Der Nazi fährt nach Palästina," a Nazi travels to Palestine. And indeed, Zionists were treated much more positively by the Nazis than other Jews in the 30s, before the genocide, I mean. So this is a matter of record, historical record. I'm not inventing anything. Therefore, opposition to Zionism, opposition to Israeli policy of the last 2 years that many qualify as genocide, has nothing to do with anti-Semitism, has nothing to do with the hatred of Jews. It has to do with the unspeakable horror that the Israeli armed forces unleashed on civilian population. And, you know, in the end of my short book, I compare it to the siege of Leningrad, but much larger territory, which a lot fewer munitions used against it. So I think that mistaking Jews for Israel is politically convenient for many European leaders, but it's totally wrong. And moreover, today, I think in the United States, young Jews have turned against Israel. They certainly don't share this Zionist commitment of their grandparents or parents. And there were several articles appearing in recent months by Zionists. So we are losing the youth. We are losing the Jewish youth. And that's why recently there was an acquisition of TikTok, of CBS, and other media by a very prominent Zionist, so that this can be corrected. Netanyahu himself said that that's the eighth front that Israel is fighting on. There was, you know, Yemen and Palestine and all that, but also the eighth front is in the United States for the hearts of the population, and the hearts are turning very much against Israel.
What do you think, like, from your studies of how this went, how Zionism developed, what was the most important pillars of its success? Like the fact that it went from a Protestant kind of idea of gathering the Jews in a place that's not Europe and gets us closer to Judgment Day to some intellectuals somewhere in Vienna, down to a Congress, down to a movement, over then to a congregation in Jerusalem, to highly violent gangs that managed to even take over and then be given by the early UN this state and then build that. I mean, this is, it's in a sense, it's a mind-boggling success story. Highly violent, very, very nasty, but highly successful. If you had to pinpoint the three or four pillars of this.
Well, the first was the genuine suffering of Jews in the Russian Empire. I'm talking about prior to 1917. So that was a real issue. But the vast majority, over 99% of Jews who emigrated from the Russian Empire, emigrated to the Americas, to North America or to Latin America. So it was not a solution for them, for themselves. However, there was more anti-Semitism after the First World War in Poland, in all these East European countries that were turning more or less fascist and anti-Semitic. So there was emigration from Poland and from Germany, obviously, when Nazi took power in Germany. And then there was the genocide. Genocide of Jews and of others by the Nazis, which created a perfectly justified sense of horror among many people who discovered it. You know, industrialized destruction of people. So the reaction in the world was very sympathetic towards the survivors. And the Zionist movement used this genocide as a very powerful reason that Jews need a separate state. But that's one lesson that they drew from the Nazi genocide. There could be another lesson that I personally draw from the Nazi genocide, that you have to be very careful in creating regimes that discriminate on the basis of ethnicity or religion. So in other words, for liberal society, where there is, when discrimination is illegal. So that very two opposite lessons that you learn from the genocide. However, for Europe, it was very convenient to export their guilt to West Asia. Mm-hmm. And they exported this whole issue to West Asia, to Palestine, where Palestinians had to pay for the sins of the Europeans. They were displaced, they were exiled, they were killed, and so on. They had done nothing wrong for Jews. But they were the ones to pay for it. Now, you have to understand that in 1948, colonialism was still legitimate.
Right.
Now, some people today, and you often hear it, the Second World War is a fight against racism. Well, not quite. American troops were segregated. After the Second World War, you had very violent colonial wars in East Africa, in North Africa, by the victorious nations. Oh, yeah, in Southeast Asia, of course. By the victorious nations, by Britain, France, and later United States. So colonialism was still legitimate. And therefore, Balfour's, one of his letters, he said that he's not interested in the opinions of a few thousand Arabs who happened to live in Palestine, just happened to be, because that's a normal colonial attitude. You don't expect anything else. No, we have to be really, as a historian, I'm very much aware that the values we professed for the last few decades are very recent. That European history is based on racism and colonial exploitation. And that's the major part of history. And then after the Second World War, there was a decline of legitimacy for colonialism. And I'm not sure that that decline is final.
No, I mean, there's people who work actively against this. And I mean, in a sense, we tend today to look at colonialism and judge that it failed, right? Or that we came out of it. But that leaves out the observation that colonialism successfully genocided three continents, North America, South America mostly, and Australia. I mean, successfully. I mean, eradicated. They are irrelevant, these people. There's a couple of survivors, but they're literally tucked away in little mini Gazas in North America. And like, I mean, it's completely, completely destroyed. The world would look different, entirely different. I mean, the two, especially North and South America, had it not been for European colonialism, right? Like, people would physically look different.
But there was, you're right, if I may interrupt you. I just wanted to explain that very often colonialism was justified by religious motives.
Yes.
For those who colonized North America, the British colonizers, they considered they're going to a promised land.
Right.
Those who colonized Australia, in particular Tasmania, it was a promised land for them. Look at the biblical names of towns and cities in the United States, you know, Bethlehem, Akron, and all that. These are traces of this idea of promised land, and promised land belongs to us, not to someone else, not to someone who happens to live there now. So this is European history.
That's why I interpret what Israel, you know, the Zionists of Israel are doing in Palestine as just the latest kind of a late version of that. And part of the anger is definitely that it's not that there's opposition to it. It's like, why is it wrong when we do it, but it was fine when you guys did it over there? And somehow the Europeans intuitively understand that. It's like, this time let's have, the Jews should also have their little colonialism and so on. I mean, this stupid framing of it.
Well, I think indeed there is a movement in Europe towards less tolerance, towards tolerance towards Muslims, towards Arabs, and so on. And that dovetails with support for Israel. So, for example, you know, you have to see Israel really as part of European history. Again, I keep hammering at the word European. European, I mean also Australia and North America and all that.
Yeah.
That expansion of Europeans. Because Israel is doing something that was done even more cruel in North America.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's doing it with more sophisticated technical means, you know, artificial intelligence and all that. But it's doing essentially the same thing. And so there is, I think, a fundamental sympathy for what Israel is doing.
A very racist, a very European sympathy. I mean, we just need to remember what the French did in Algeria 60 years ago. And it's not long ago, and they're still not willing to kind of admit that, well, it was kind of bad.
Well, some people argue that the whole idea of inclusiveness and race, anti-racism is a very thin layer of lacquer that can be scratched without too much effort. And we see that just recent a Nobel Peace Prize winner, I think Mrs. Machado.
Yeah.
what is she? I mean, just look at her record, and that's very relevant. You would say, well, what does Venezuela have to do with Israel? It does have to do something. Because Mrs. Machado recently spoke at a meeting of extreme right-wing parties in Europe.
Yeah.
She gave a speech, and a very Islamophobic speech. And also she said that when and if she becomes president of Venezuela, the first thing she would do is to transfer the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Well, you see very close links between what goes on elsewhere in the world with what Israel does and is. And that explains partly this remarkable support for Israel that you find among the ruling classes in in Europe and in countries of European settlement. It's really surprising. The pro forma recognition of the Palestinian state a few weeks ago, really, doesn't change very much. So we have to understand why support for Israel is so common among the ruling classes, among the wealthiest part of the population. They have nothing to do with Jews and Judaism.
But then why? I mean, yesterday, the day before yesterday, Donald Trump, in front of the whole congregation in the Knesset, actually applauded Mrs. Adelson and actually said $60 billion, and her husband would just call her in his first term and just storm in and tell him what needs to be done. And he applauded her. It's like, why is it that Israel is that good at getting itself into the highest echelons in the United States, but everywhere else? And at the end of the day, I mean, without the British, without Balfour, without Zionist contacts into these highest political circles, that wouldn't have been possible either. What makes them so good at this?
Well, an easy explanation which anti-Semites give is that Jews are very powerful and therefore they influence all kinds of governments. I don't buy this explanation because most Jews are not powerful. And they are not, and they don't have entries into the ruling classes. That's for sure. So why is Israel so popular among the, you see, I'm studiously avoiding the word elite. I call them ruling class because elite is something else. You know, for me, elite is an elite cello player. It's an elite, but say, President Macron is not. Well, he may play cello, I don't know.
He can't be very good, otherwise he wouldn't be friends of France. Anyhow.
So I think that it's very important to understand that Israel supplies high technology, surveillance methods, very important know-how of population control around the world. Because Israel is very good at it. It has been doing it for many decades, and it's all tested on Palestinians. This technology and know-how is bought by all kinds of countries. Also, weapons are bought by all kinds of countries, but particularly surveillance and population control. Why is it so important today? Because, as you know, there's a crisis in many countries. Crisis largely caused by extreme disbalance between the wealthy and the poor, and the growing pauperization of population, declining life expectancy among white people in the United States, just a good example of that. These people are frustrated, they are angry, their children are not going to live the life that they lived, and therefore, these people can be very violent and and start all kinds of insurrections. You have to control them. That is one explanation. Another explanation that there is sympathy for this colonial entity in West Asia, which as some Islamophobes in Europe say, well, Israel knows how to deal with Arabs. We should learn from them. And indeed, police from many cities in North America, for sure. I know in Canada that happens. Police is sent to Israel to learn experience of Israeli police forces. It's the same thing in the United States. Maybe in Europe, I'm just not sure. So Israel is a very important source of population control. And this under the conditions of unprecedented division between rich and poor is very important to keep the power. So it's a very simple explanation.
I mean, in this reading, Israel is basically the outpost, a successful outpost of bygone or believed to be bygone European colonialism. However, that is kind of testing and experimenting with the newest ways of controlling its environment and therefore living up to this good old European tradition of brutal violence in order to get its way. So and well, reciprocal relationship, actually.
Yes, it is. And, you know, it brings to mind an old film, The Kid by Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah.
Remember that the kid breaks the window and then comes the glazier ready to repair. So right. Israel does something like that. It destabilizes entire West Asia, creates waves of immigration towards Europe, and then teaches Europe how to deal with this.
With the same kind of violence that they used. Yeah, I mean, it's horrible. It's just, it works. That's the point. Professor Rapkin, people who want to buy your book, I suppose I'll send them to the online bookstore to get it from there. And I also link to other books. Is there any other place where people can follow your writings?
Well, the most recent book that you mentioned, you can place the link, israelpalestinebook.com, and there all the information how to buy it and where to buy it. But other books are available just as this one on Amazon, on other in other bookstores. So after deploring the social injustice, it's strange for me to advertise Amazon, but but anyway,
we all live in the structures that we have to be in the years we are. So Professor Yaakov Rapkin, thank you very much for your time today.
It was my pleasure.
And that brings us to the close of this week's episode. As always, stay curious, stay courageous, and keep asking the questions that unsettle power, challenge silence, and illuminate the path to justice. I'm Abby Mossery, your host and narrator. It's been a deep and humbling honor to share this space with you, a space where truth is spoken without dilution, where resistance is held with reverence, and where solidarity is never up for negotiation. If you have thoughts, reflections, or questions, if you'd like to support the work we do, or feel called to step behind the mic as a future host, we'd love to hear from you. You can reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To our listeners, thank you for your time, your trust, your willingness to walk this path with us, and to the brilliant team whose vision and dedication keep this platform alive: Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Mosa, Dr. Rana Awad, Dr. Bethany Marks, Professor Yara Rashid, Juliet Salame Olivier, Reynaud Al-Ghul, and our editor, Mohamed Al-Ghul. Your labor, your spirit, and your unwavering commitment are the heartbeat of this show. You remind us that storytelling is not just a craft, it's a form of resistance, a form of care, a form of collective memory. Until next time, keep walking toward truth, keep walking toward Palestine. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, proudly broadcasting from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. Until then, take care and stay steadfast.